Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. Our guest today is Fox Sports play-by-play man Joe Buck. He'll be calling Packers-Falcons on Fox on Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern and the Super Bowl on Fox 2 weeks later. He also recently released his memoir entitled Lucky Bastard and hosts an interview series called Undeniable on DirecTV. Undeniable returns Wednesday, February 15th on Audience Sports, which is Channel 39. Joe, you've been calling NFL on Fox for over 20 years. Have you ever seen a quarterback who has the mobility, strength, and accuracy to make that third and 20 throw to Jared Cook that Aaron Rodgers made on Sunday?
No, and I've watched it a couple of times since. When you're doing it live, you don't really realize how incredible of a play it was, but, you know, you get home and you watch the replay of it, and then I saw it last night on NFL Network, and you just realize the athletic ability and skill it takes to be rolling out to your left, put it up, pull it down, roll out further, and then just flick it along the sidelines and put it right on the perfect spot to hit Jared Cook. And I know that Mason Crosby was brilliant there at the end, and they don't win without Mason Crosby. But in essence, one guy beat the Dallas Cowboys. And that one guy is a quarterback that I just haven't seen combine all those athletic gifts with what he does mentally, like catching teams trying to substitute and the hard count. And there's just another layer and another element to his game that you don't see, even with, you know, arguably the greatest quarterback ever, Tom Brady. It's just different doing his game.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. You wrote in your book that sometimes you get a sense in the pregame meetings and seeing practices, you know who's going to win. For example, you said you knew that the Packers were going to beat the Steelers in early 2011, and you knew that the Seahawks were going to beat the Broncos in early 2014. The last couple weeks doing these Packers games, did you know beforehand that with Aaron Rodgers locked in like this, that they were going to win those games?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, probably just being boastful in my book, I had a really good sense of which team was ready and relaxed. And, you know, that was certainly the case for Seattle against Denver. I mean, that was a team that was out for blood defensively, and they were going to physically intimidate the Denver Broncos. And yeah, I thought the Green Bay Packers practice when they were about to face the Steelers in Super Bowl 45 was just different. It was faster paced. It had more crispness to it compared to Pittsburgh. But if I really knew, I would probably shove all of my earnings to the center of the table somewhere in Vegas and double down every time. And I'm not that confident. But I've seen I've seen Aaron Rodgers the last few weeks, and I've gotten to know him obviously over the years. I talked to him on the field before the game on Sunday, as did Troy. And Troy and I came up and kind of compared notes. We talked to him at different times, and it was like, man, Aaron Rodgers was totally relaxed, and that just tells me that a guy before one of the biggest games of his career on the road felt like he had a real good chance of taking apart a defense. And we all saw what they did the first three times they touched the ball. They weren't stoppable. So yeah, I've seen that look in the eye of Aaron Rodgers before. The last time I saw it in the postseason was 2010. Now we see it again, and I wouldn't be surprised if they went all the way and won it all, but it's more than Aaron Rodgers. I mean, they have to defensively, you know, cover a lot of holes because of injuries, and that's always the X factor in these games. And those holes almost cost them a huge Cowboy comeback on Sunday.
Yeah, I talked about this with AJ Hawk. Morgan Burnett going down really made a huge difference in what the Cowboys were able to do.
Yeah, he's their quarterback back there. And if the Packers have had problems with injuries in their secondary, the injuries have happened in their corners. And the one thing they've been able to rely on are the two really good safeties that they have. And I think that allows Dom Capers to do what he wants with blitzes and, you know, one-on-one coverage on the outside and the help that he gets from his safeties because they're smart, they're athletic, and they're good. So you take one of those guys away, it's a big loss. You know, who knows where we stand now as you and I talk on a Tuesday, but I do believe that's a major hit to a defense that's going to be under severe stress against Matt Ryan and the Atlanta Falcons.
Deservedly, all of the talk is on Aaron Rodgers, but do you think that the Falcons could really be using this as motivation? I mean, obviously, both teams want to win the game, and they always want to win the game, but the Falcons, they're home favorites. They beat the Packers already this season. Matt Ryan deserves to be the presumptive MVP of the league. Do you think that they're in actually like a sneaky good position with all of the conversation centering around the Packers?
Absolutely. I think Aaron Rodgers has to almost be perfect week in and week out. And I'll tell you, he's come pretty close during this winning streak. You know, they've won what, 8 in a row, and they've gone from 4-6 to this incredible run. And so, you know, when you've got one guy that kind of is carrying the whole load against a team that's really good and a team that's really good at home, setting franchise records and points and what they've done offensively, and it's gotten Kyle Shanahan to the top of the list for the San Francisco 49ers for head coach spot. Yeah, I think the Atlanta Falcons go into this game believing they can win. And it's nice to see a good guy like Matt Ryan kind of shut up all the critics with what he did against Seattle in the division playoff. And now we'll see what he does with his real chance to get to his first Super Bowl.
You've had an unbelievable amount of like big games that you've called over the last 20 plus years at Fox Sports. And you've, as we said before, you've got the NFC Championship game and the Super Bowl coming up. A lot of the focus on the play-by-play man comes in their calls. And so both what they say and how they say it, all of this is subjective as we're going to get to later. But one of the, I think, underrated aspects of your job, and I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you right now. I think that right now you're the best at introducing a game. The cameras shoot to you. You're the first thing that we see, and you have to convey that this is a big event. How do you go about preparing for conveying that gravity to however many millions of people are watching?
Well, it's kind of a weird balance. You know, you want to be serious. You want to be kind of loud. You know, when guys get off the field and they go to the broadcast booth, one thing you have to kind of make them understand is part of it is acting. Part of it is being louder than you would talk in normal conversation or louder than they talked when they were being interviewed. A lot of those guys, you know, have to ratchet it up a notch. And so you have to be up, you have to be serious, but you have to do it. At least the way I try to do it is, you know, we're not doing a refueling of an F-18 in midair here. We're not curing cancer and we're not trying to disarm North Korea. We're about to watch a football game. And as silly as it is, sometimes I think we all take this stuff way too seriously. It for some reason can feel like, even for me, life and death. You know, you're trying to be perfect. It's a live event, and I've had to actually write things on my board that I produce for every game as little reminders to relax. You know, I think, you know, you lose a little bit of the fun the bigger the games get. If I'm doing this game, Green Bay and Atlanta, in August during the preseason, it's going to have a much different feel and a much different tone. And I'm not saying that you bring that into an NFC championship game, but it's still a game. And I think a lot of guys lose that. I do a lot of the time myself. So you're serious, you're loud, you're up, but you can have a little bit of a conversational tone also, which hopefully, you know, the viewer enjoys. Now, what you were referring to earlier is the whole, well, he got too loud for the Dallas touchdown and he wasn't as loud for the Green Bay touchdown, and everybody kind of assigns some sort of, you know, importance to your call, and then they compare them. And, you know, if I'm there rooting on my couch for the Green Bay Packers, I'm going nuts when the Packers score. I don't really care what the announcer says. But if I'm, you know, throwing stuff at the TV and the Cowboys score and the announcer's screaming and yelling like he did for the Packers, well, it sounds like he's rooting against the Packers. So you have to kind of take that on, digest it, and throw it away and know it's out there, but not let it cripple you. And that's kind of I feel like that's the way this business is going more and more. And I'm not saying social media is a bad thing. I think it's a really helpful tool, but I think it's given voice to a lot of that stuff. And it just takes on a life of its own when there's nothing there that's even credible in at the very least.
You've taken a lot of criticism over the years, and that's been well documented. What was interesting to me is we met very briefly in Green Bay a couple weeks ago, and there are a couple Giants fans in the lobby of your hotel who were like, "Hey, Joe Buck, come take a picture with my dog." You didn't really want to do it, but you went and took the picture with them. But they had a very like positive reaction to seeing you in person. You mentioned on Bill Simmons's podcast that you were once chased out of a bar and you had to walk briskly to your hotel room to deal with a couple of hecklers. But I feel like you must get much more praise versus criticism when you're face to face with people versus the ratio on social media. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think people are individually and face to face really nice. And that's why a lot of the stuff on social media kind of becomes a game, you know, who can be more cutting or who can be funnier than the last guy criticizing the dumb announcer. And, you know, on one hand, you want to just hand anybody that has any of that to say about me or Troy or Phil Sims or Jim Nance or Chris Collinsworth, it's like, here's a headset, knock yourself out, see how you do. And I'll sit back and I'll split everything that you say and dissect it all and show you how dumb you are. But personally, people are great. You know, they'll pat you on the back. Hey, this call was cool. And I don't ever give anybody any reason when I meet them to walk away and go, what a jerk, you know, what a stuck up. I'm the luckiest guy in the world. That's why the title of my book is what it is. And I grew up in this business and I saw my dad, how he treated people. And that's how I treat people. And so consequently, even the harshest critic, somebody will come up and give me trouble in a bar in New York or Boston or Green Bay or whatever. And then you engage in conversation or you give them a smile or whatever, and they'll, you know, buy you a drink. And it just proves that a lot of that stuff isn't personal. And so it's easier to handle that way. Because, you know, I feel like I'm a nice guy and I feel like I try to treat people the way I'd like to be treated. And sometimes when that stuff piles up online, you go, hey, wait a minute. Let's be fair here. But, you know, nobody's crying for me. And if I'm going to be Mr. Big Shot cashing the checks and doing the big games, that's just the way of life. And you have to put up with it. And it's fine.
Yeah, you mentioned the social media criticism. It's one thing when it comes there, and then it's another when it comes from professional people. Like you mentioned in your book that in the St. Louis paper, there was a guy who ripped you for purported nepotism early in your career. And you recently went on Bill Simmons' podcast, I think really to your credit, because he's been very harsh with you for years. And he's not just a guy on Twitter. He was really the most prominent writer for ESPN. And he said that there were only two times he went after you. And I looked up and he was off by at least several. There were many more times than the two that he brought up. He ripped your HBO book and he ripped your HBO show in the ESPN book, and then he didn't make it to a second season on HBO. Was there a part of you with that, when that was going on, that you were kind of, a part of you was like happy to see that he wasn't an overwhelming success there?
No, I'm just not that way. You know, I think TV's hard. The difference between his show and my show was live. And I mean, it was live. So I can prove that by the Artie Lang appearance on it. And, you know, I think my show didn't work for a lot of different reasons, but I'm proud of every second of that show. And I'd put it up against anything, especially because it was legitimately live. So I look back on my HBO time and I'm proud of it. You know, whether it survived or didn't survive, I think there are other factors involved. And for Bill, you know, I've been a fan of Bill's and I've read his stuff. I'm not a huge NBA guy, so, you know, he doesn't really come across my radar all that often. But, you know, his criticism of me was because I had the audacity in 2004 to, you know, remind Red Sox fans or the baseball viewing public, which, by the way, is bigger than Boston Red Sox fans, that the Red Sox hadn't won since 1918. I mean, that's a part of the story. And the local fans of those teams, whether it's Bill Simmons or it's John Smith, you have to say that stuff. That's part of the narrative of a game, just the same as it is with the Cubs. And they haven't won since 1908. Well, every Cub fan's rolling their eyes. But it's, you can't ignore that as the national broadcaster telling the story to the general population. So, you know, some of those criticisms are just kind of not very realistic or don't really make a whole lot of sense. But I don't root for anybody to fail. And I was sad that his show came and went. I was excited when he got the show because, to me, as somebody who tried it out at HBO and it didn't work, I wanted to see somebody do something that resonated, and for whatever reason, it didn't. But, you know, that's his career, and I do believe in karma. I don't sit back and laugh when somebody else doesn't succeed. That's not the way I live my life.
In your book, you wrote a part. It wasn't that the mob put out a hit on you and you had to like go into hiding or anything, but there was an interaction with your dad and somebody in the mob who they made kind of a veiled threat, like, if you cross me, I just think about Joe. Can you explain the background of that?
I can try. It's a little convoluted, but the gist of it is my dad had borrowed money. I think the common perception is that, you know, my dad was just raking in cash. And I mean, he was working hard and doing a lot of different jobs and didn't have a ton of cash and had been through a divorce, which is obvious, as you know, detailed in the book. And, you know, where I come from, and again, why the title of my book is Lucky Bastard, there's a, you know, a literal meaning there for me as well. But he had borrowed money from somebody that he probably shouldn't have borrowed money from, and was, that guy was under investigation eventually for, you know, other matters. And the police, my dad was always friends with the police in town, and investigators wanted to talk to my dad about this person. And when this person found it out that my dad was going to potentially talk to investigators about him, he paid a visit to my dad and said, "Well, you got a pretty new young wife, huh? Yeah. You've got a new son. What's his name? Joe? Yeah. We're keeping an eye on him," as if to say, "Hey, if you talk about our guy, something bad's going to happen to your family." And, you know, fortunately, my dad had that relationship with members of the St. Louis police. Let's say it was a different era back then. And the head of detectives, Doherty, went and paid this guy a visit and said, if Jack Buck's son Joe skins his knee, we're coming after you physically. So it's just kind of one of the weird stories of my young life that I obviously was not aware of back then, but something my dad and I talked about when I was age appropriate to find that out.
I really enjoyed reading about your relationship with your dad, because I didn't previously realize that you would travel with him on the road when you were young to even places like Las Vegas or New York. And it totally was a different era where at nights you could kind of be free on your own. Well, he went out and did his thing. Another way that it was like a different era is I'm 30, so I know he's a legendary baseball broadcaster. I didn't realize that he had done, like, he was on the top CBS NFL team with Pat Summerall until I wrote a piece on Madden and Summerall recently. And you also had an interesting thing in your book where your dad would, like, when you were out to dinner, he would draw up on a napkin and tally up his net worth in hopes of getting to $1 million with all of his assets. And you juxtapose that with your meteoric rise where you were, where you got to call the World Series in 1996 when you were in your late 20s. And you bought these like really big houses as your career was rising. Do you think that was like a really interesting dynamic and how different the times were, like based on like how your different careers went that way?
Yeah, and you know, he was really proud of both sides of it. He was proud that he was a kid that grew up during the Depression, only got to go to college because of the GI Bill after World War II, and went to Ohio State and made his own way. And yeah, he was, because I guess when you grow up in the Depression and you don't have anything as a kid and you start to accumulate some net worth, you know, as I joke in the book, it was like he'd throw the car in there and the house, and it wasn't like he had $1 million cash. But once he got to seven figures, he was proud. And I noticed that as a, you know, teenager. It didn't happen early in my life, even. It took him a while to get there. And I never saw anybody work harder. And then I come along and I'm the beneficiary of all that stuff. You know, I'm broadcasting big league baseball as the Cardinals announcer at the age of 21. And then Fox comes along at the right time, and I'm a, you know, third or fourth string football announcer in 94 when I'm 25. And then they get baseball and I'm doing the World Series at 27. And what comes with that are good contracts. And I know my dad was as proud of what I did my way and kind of steering my career toward television as he was with what he built up, mainly as a radio guy, but then certainly with some TV thrown in, especially at the end of his career. So, yeah, I trace all of, you know, everything I have goes back to how I grew up, the example I saw from my dad, the way I saw him treat people, and the hard work ethic that he had every day of his life. And so, you know, I've been the most fortunate guy I know. And it's really why at the age of 47, I wanted to write a book. It's, you know, and not everything's been rosy, as you know, and everybody's got their own things that they have to go through. But I've been really fortunate, and I trace it all back to what I saw my dad do and the time he took with me to show me what this business was all about. I was doing games into a tape recorder when I was 13. And I was broadcasting professionally during the summers in Louisville when I was 19. So I did work hard, and I did, you know, I wasn't a screw-off kid that was just, you know, running around following the Grateful Dead in the summer like some of my friends. I was working. And so, you know, I was fortunate that work turned into these opportunities at Fox that came along kind of out of the sky. And, you know, that's where a lot of that luck falls in, but it's luck combined with a lot of hard work.
You had a 2 to 3 year rough patch that you briefly alluded to. The situation where the hair plug treatment really messed up your voice for upwards of a year, that's made the rounds a lot. But one of the things that I didn't realize until I read the book was that healed kind of like after you tried all these types of things and doctors, you were helped healed a little bit by holistic medicine. How did that happen?
Well, it was Aaron Shannon, who is the youngest child, daughter of Mike Shannon, longtime Cardinal announcer, former Cardinal player, and her mom died of brain cancer. And when she was going through her therapy, Aaron, who was studying, I think, psychology, saw the relief that a holistic doctor had brought her mom when she was at her sickest. And so she started to follow that as a career path. And she, you know, said to me one night during the World Series, during the postseason, but I think specifically the World Series, hey, I can relieve some of the stress on your vocal cord and on your throat. And she did it, you know, holistically. And I don't know what goes into that. All I know is within a week, a lot of the stress I was feeling was gone from my neck. And my vocal cord was working well enough to make that, we'll see you tomorrow night, Jack Buck tribute call in game 6 of 2011. And at the end of this ridiculously terrible year for any broadcaster, I win an Emmy, basically based on one call of a home run hit by David Freese. But, you know, I also think it had a lot to do with time and timing. You know, I was waiting for a nerve to regenerate, like Peyton Manning was waiting for nerves to regenerate. And it did at the right time. And so it was a blessing that it came back at that time. And, you know, without that healing, I probably wouldn't be talking to you right now. I'd be doing something else. But fortunately, it took, you know, just under a year for the thing to come back. And if it didn't, I don't know. I don't know what I would have done with my life, but I could not have continued to broadcast with the kind of voice that I had. It just didn't sound good.
I know you've got to get moving this afternoon. Is there anything that we didn't discuss about your career or the upcoming NFL matchups that you think is really important and want to talk about right now?
I am dying to talk about nothing, but I appreciate it very much. And I think we've covered a lot. We've gone from Aaron Rodgers and the Packers to hair plugs to holistic medicine. There's a lot of ground that we covered in the last 20 minutes, so I'm proud of you. Good job.
Thank you, Joe. I really appreciate you coming on. Looking forward to watching your calls the next couple weeks. Have a great rest of the week.
All right. Take care. Thanks.
Bye.